Hi, I'm Casey Hald. This is my podcast called Talk Product. I'm here with Drew Wilson. And to give some context, we already recorded this episode. And not just that, but we recorded at Drew's house in his office. Perfect weather. I said it way too much. I over-elaborated like how good the weather was. And we had everything to be successful, and yet I failed miserably on that initial recording. So, Drew, how are you doing?
Doing good. Thanks for having me again. Mm-hmm. Glad to participate and make the wrongs right.
Yes.
Get some solid audio in here.
Awesome. Yeah. And you are overly gracious with your time. I mean, you could have easily, after I sent that to you, you could have told me to pound sand and I would have been like, yeah, that's fair. I did a terrible job of this.
Kick rocks, my
there
friend.
There goes Drew. It was fun. But no, you were very kind. And you agreed to do another recording. So I appreciate you coming on once again. But we did get some really good audio clips. I made a Drew soundboard of all of the garble that came from the first recording. To kind of give some more explanation, I recorded on a single soundtrack, and that is a no-no when it comes to recording on location. I am very much not a audio expert. This is a hobby, and I am learning and growing as I do this. And this is one thing that I've learned through this process. And so to try to salvage together the audio that I had to get rid of the echo that came from us being in the same room and me not recording on two separate tracks, I put my faith in AI and ran with it, uploaded it, sent it to Drew, and we got what we got, didn't we, Drew?
Yeah, we did. We got a pretty great surprise.
Should I go ahead and play one of these just to see how crazy you sound?
Yeah. Let's show the people what it was.
All right, this is you saying doing good.
Doing good.
A little 8-bit fun in there. I mean, some of them are pretty ridiculous. When you sent me like, hey, Drew, got the episode uploaded. I remember taking a look at it and just immediately busting out in laughter and being like, there is no way a living soul would understand anything that's being said by me.
You mean this?
You took the elevator. We took the trail.
Literally world record breaking on the audio.
Oh my God.
Right there.
So funny. But yeah, I mean, with the advancements of AI and it being sort of scary and seeing the capabilities of it, I must have picked the worst filter or something went awry.
Chipmunk alien.
This one too.
And so that's why, if you look at it a little bit, you look at it on a bar chart with a course of value consistory, it's never really gone up. And you're not trying to make it go up. I'm not trying to make a lot of money.
Okay, the ending sounded pretty good, but it definitely went hurdle.
Sounds just like me.
Yeah. You know what it sounds like? It sounds like we were recording a podcast while I was interrogating you to find out where the enemies of the state were. And I was like,
yeah,
you know, putting your head in a toilet and being like, where's the enemies?
Yeah.
And
I was in the middle of being waterboarded.
You're being waterboarded. Or we did a podcast like under the ocean, like scuba diving or something.
Yeah.
So good. So Drew, let's try this again, shall we? I guess the first question I have for you is, when did you first, and I know you already answered this, and we did such a great job. We had such a good cadence, but we're going to go ahead and do this again. When did you first start getting into building things on the internet? Like, what got you into web design? What got you interested in it?
Yeah, for me, it was pretty early on. So I built my first website sometime around 96. Maybe it was a little earlier, but sometime around 96 is when I built my first actual website where I coded the HTML and all that kind of jazz myself. And that was on like either AngelFire or GeoCities, one of the two, I can't remember, because I had accounts on both of them. And what got me into it was, you know, AOL, America Online, and having access to that early, you know, as a kid chatting on the internet, the next natural step is to want to make your own page. And so that's kind of where it started for me. I got into design because my dad had his own comic book business where he bought and sold old comics. And he had, I think, the first mail order catalog available nationwide. And so he would take old comics. He would take a large piece of massive newspaper and blank newspaper, and he would take photos with his camera of the comics that he's going to sell. And some of these are consigned by the people even. And then he would use a typewriter to type out the name of the comic, maybe the condition. And then he would paste that up on this giant page. And he pastes the photo up, and then underneath it, the typewriter bit about the name of the comic, et cetera. And he would create these master pages, and he'd take them down to the local newspaper shop, the local newspaper, and pay them to run this as a catalog. And so then you'd come out with like a smaller version of it, and it'd be a catalog that he would then mail out across the U.S. to a bunch of customers. And as kids, we did that where we would stuff the catalog in the envelope, put the address label on, and ship it out. And when Photoshop came out, my dad was actually an early adopter on Apple and Macs. And so we never had a PC in the house. We always had Apples. And when Photoshop came out, he realized, holy smokes, this is a game changer. And Photoshop V1, he was scanning his photos with a giant scanner that took like an hour just to scan one image, and then paste that up. And then he could create his master sheets in Photoshop. Actually, it was PageMaker before that is what he was using. Then when Photoshop came out, V2, it had layers that made it even easier. And Apple, around that same time, came out with America's first digital camera for resale, like consumer digital camera. It looked like a pair of binoculars. And it had a tiny resolution, and it didn't do very much color, but it was color. And it was good enough for a comic book on a small size that was going to be in a magazine or in a catalog. And so he started using that camera to take photos of his comics to then put into the catalog, and did it all in Photoshop. And so I was exposed to Photoshop like around V2 and started messing around with it then from a different perspective, from like trying to build websites. And so that's where it all started for me. Was comic books.
Nice. You know what's funny? I actually have a clip of you saying America Online in your garble.
America Online.
Did I say that last time? Holy smokes. Yeah, I'm like a record and I don't even know.
I got
know
a
it.
Holy smokes too. Check this one out.
And I'm like, holy smokes.
It's so like for some reason that one became all high pitched.
I'm not even a real person. I'm like just a robot just repeating stuff. I didn't even realize this. I feel like I'm in the Matrix.
That's all good, because I'm sure when I use that AI filter, it uploaded your audio sample to the cloud. So now your voice is just going to be used for who knows what purposes now on the internet. So it's fine. Don't worry about it.
Yep.
But yeah, man, like the early times of the internet was definitely crazy, especially like when I got started. I think when we talked before, I mentioned that I made a website pre-CSS, and I got started because I needed to find a way to make more money than what I was doing, which, I mean, when I was 18, 19, I was working at a tire shop, changing tires, tire technician. And then at the same time, I was working another job tending to a horse ranch. So I clean like horse poop and stuff. And I'm like, I can't keep doing this. And then moving out of the house at 19 and marrying my then girlfriend, I was like, okay, I gotta find something like a career or something that makes me better money than what I'm doing now, because this isn't working. And I was able to get into a community college, found a technical program for just web design, and hit the ground running with that. Barely spent any money. I got hired right out of class, which is great. Worked for a marketing studio that did mostly like political ads. Like they did a lot of campaigns for politicians and stuff, where they make those like bashing websites where they bash another politician. And I got to Photoshop some people with like goat horns and stuff. It was crazy. So I got to learn how to do Photoshop and do the like photo bashing, while at the same time helping code those landing pages. And I just did one after another. I think we did like at least 5 to 10 a month. we were able to push a lot. So from that very first job, I kind of developed the muscle memory of just taking a design and splicing it apart, and taking the next design, splicing it apart. And that's kind of how I got started. It was just right into the frying pan, right out of school, and just hitting the ground running with it. It was crazy.
Yeah. Yeah. A lot of similarities there for me too. Like in Washington State, I was homeschooled my whole life until high school. And I grew up in a small town. There were less people in the town I grew up in than there were people in the high school that I ended up going to. After my parents got divorced, we moved to Vancouver, Washington, and there was more people in that high school than in the town I grew up in. So it was culture shock for me, but I was only there for 2 years because in Washington State, you can do your last 2 years of high school at a college, a community college. So I did. So I graduated high school and with my AA at the same time when I was 17. And then I never went back to school. And I had taught myself, like I mentioned, how to build websites when I was 13 is when I built my first one. And then a few years later, taught myself how to code in PHP. I never wanted to code. I always thought it was like this super nerdy thing. And I just like did not want to do it. But then, you know, knowing nobody that knew how to code and I would design things, I'm like, how in the world am I supposed to like ever bring these things to life? And I always had ideas, stuff that I wanted to build. So I just bit the bullet and started writing code, and turned out I loved it. So stuck with it, you know, since then, always being able to build, design and build my own stuff, which was great. I've always kind of been entrepreneurial. Back in that little tiny town, when I was 9, I like my first venture was baking and selling muffins at a local hair salon there. And like you, spent a lot of time in the horse stalls because we had horses on our property.
Oh, wow. So and, you bucked hay and all that?
So, yeah, yeah. I grew up cleaning the horse stalls. Like it was one of my chores, you know, mowing the 3 lawns we had because we had a decent size property. We had like 5 acres. And a lot of that was lawn and a lot of it was like field and forest. And we had animals. So we had a goat. We had horses. We had like 13 dogs, not all at once, but over the course of those like 7 years during my period in childhood, there was like 13 dogs. We had bunny rabbits. We had cats, chickens, like we had them all. And, you know, as kids grew up, you have to take care of that stuff. So yeah, it was a very different experience. And so that kind of background for me, when it came to like, okay, now I can code and I can build things. I wasn't exposed to like the business side of stuff at all growing up in a small town. And my dad was an entrepreneur, but that word was never once said at any point in time. It's like he had his own business. There was no such thing that I knew of as an entrepreneur. I didn't know what that was. Didn't know what Silicon Valley was, none of that stuff. And it took me a long time to like get to the point where I even knew what that stuff was. So when I was first building websites for people and doing client work, like my biggest ambition I could ever think of was like one day I will make a website for a big corporation. Yeah. It's like, I don't even know what a big corporation is. Like you asked me to define that. I would be like, I don't know, a big business. And so it's just a very, I don't know, small town mindset that stuck around with me for a very long time. And then when I moved down here to Southern California, I didn't know a soul, but I knew I wanted to be out of the Washington weather and wanted to be into this in the sunshine and the surf. And I came down here and kind of like you, was just like stuck right into the fray. Okay, I gotta figure out how I'm gonna make money, and gotta figure out, you know, what I'm gonna do. And I had been doing design even as a teenager for like pay. Like every now and again, I would have like a paid job. Super small stuff like posters for festivals or like a small business website, that sort of thing. And so I decided that's what I'll do. But I didn't know anybody, so I had no clients. And when I first moved down, I didn't have any money and I had no way to get money. And so I ended up on food stamps and welfare, for a little while. And it's like super embarrassing to have to go sit in the welfare office learning how to fill out an application with like a bunch of other people, and you're in his desk and you have to go report once a week. And I would apply and I would get interviews, but I would never get a job. And so that was an interesting experience. my roommates loved it because the food stamp stuff gave me way too much as a single guy who was 18 or 19. They gave me $300 a month. And as a single guy, I'm like tapping into 100 max. And and so my roommate's like, sweet. So I would buy food for everybody. It only lasted like 6 months. And then I finally got a job at a print shop. But yeah, that was an interesting time.
Yeah, those early days for me, like when my wife and I were first married, because we got married at like 19. So we were still basically kids. We would hit Winco. That was our spot. We'd hit Winco because you can get super cheap pot pies, and we'd buy them like a bunch of pot pies. And we'd snack on those. And of course, ramen, a jam on ramen. And, yeah, early days, it really makes you humble, like looking back and seeing kind of where you came from and where you are now. And, it kind of helps you grow and develop as a person.
Yeah. Mine was, our go-to was Grocery Outlet. It was kind of across the street from where I was living, and you could get, cans of tomato sauce, which was just like mostly water, for like 25 to 40 cents. And then you could get bags of noodles, like egg noodles kind of stuff, for like 50 cents. And so that's what we would have. And then, yeah. And then when I got food stamps, it was a little better. But then once I was off food stamps, it was back to the gross stuff.
Yeah.
I always remember though, in Grocery Outlet, they had my roommate and I still reminisce about it to this day. They had the weirdest foods in there, and just like bottom of the barrel kind of companies producing like just like dumb ideas. And one of the end caps in the store for a while was this thing called sports shots. And it was literally a squeeze bottle, a sports bottle with like a little top that, you know, you pull it out, push it in like a regular sports bottle. Like you're playing basketball, you're going to take a squirt of some water. Well, it was shots. It was hard alcohol.
Oh, damn.
In a sports bottle. And the label said sports shots. And it was like people running as if they're working out. And it's vodka or something. It's like the stupidest thing ever.
So it's like a spiked 8-hour energy, basically. But you squirt it.
Yeah, but I mean, it wasn't spiked. It was literally just alcohol.
Man, that kind of reminds me of the first time I tried a Four Loko. Do you ever try one of those?
I don't know.
Okay, so Four Loko, imagine a heart attack in a can and then add alcohol. So it's like a Red Bull, but it's got like hard alcohol in it. Like it's like 8%.
Wow.
Probably more than that, probably more like 10. But I remember I was working on a website for a client way back in the day, like circa 2011, 2012. And I was like jamming on beers or whatever. And I'm like, I need something with energy in it. So I went to the gas station and I picked up a Four Loko. And man, dude, that, I don't know if it was blacking out or what it was. I was tripping on that stuff. But I was like jamming. Like before I knew it, I heard birds chirping outside. And I'm like, what just happened? And I'm like, I built this whole thing in PHP like overnight and was able to like ship this thing while drinking like this Four Loko. I'm like, never again. That was the craziest thing. And I think they still sell, or maybe they're illegal now. I'm not sure, but those were crazy.
Yeah, dude, that's like me with coffee. When I was like 17, I used to work on the Oregon coast at the beach, and I would drink coffee every morning for like a summer. And then when I left that place, nobody in my family really drank coffee that much. So we just didn't have any. So I never thought about it, never drank it, but I had a headache for like 2 weeks. And I was like, I'm never touching that stuff again. And then fast forward to like my days building Plasso, and some of my coworkers were like, yeah, you should drink coffee if you're doing these cave week things. Cause I would lock myself in the office for, you know, a week and just like code 24/7 to catch up on work. And so one time I gave in and I had an espresso, and oh my gosh, dude, I was like just shaking, like, you know, it's like so much energy for like 3 days straight. That was the longest I stayed up, was 72 hours without sleeping. And it was because of that espresso.
Just one espresso and you were up for 72 yeah. hours. Man, that's crazy.
Yeah.
I want to talk a little bit about Plasso. So I remember, like, we went to that meetup. I think it was called Circles or Shapes or something along those lines.
Shape.
And I remember you talking about Plasso, and you're saying something along the lines of, like, yeah, man, I'm almost out of money, or it was something along those lines. And you, like, someone's got to, like, pick this up or something. Otherwise, you know, this is going to run out of steam. And I was like, oh, man, that sucks. Cause I've been following your work for a while. I kind of consider you, I mean, I don't kiss ass or anything. I'm being sincere. Like, I consider you sort of the Michael Jordan of our field, like, in terms of, like, being a unicorn, running your own show, designing, developing, and actually launching the thing. A lot of us will tinker, and a lot of us will make prototypes and make proof of concepts, but not a whole lot of us ship, me included. I'm super guilty of buying way too many domains, making way too many local hosts, making an idea and not shipping it. But you seem to ship stuff. Like, you seem to just get stuff out there, get it onto the market, and kind of see what happens. So I was super bummed to hear that Plasso may sink or something was going to happen. And then I saw, either from Twitter or somewhere online, maybe LinkedIn, I don't remember, but that GoDaddy, like, bought Plasso, and I'm like, yes. I was like, he did it. He sold it. He was able to, like, you know, make some good money off of that. So I kind of want to hear a little bit of that story.
Yeah. Yeah. That was, an emotional roller coaster, as they always say. And it was, for me, it was kind of like living out that startup dream that, you know, people set out to do, where you build something from scratch, you know, building something you wish existed, and then you sell it and you make a lot of money from it. And like, that was essentially that story. You know, when it's all said and done, it seems cut and dry, but as you're going through it, it's not, you know, cut and dry at all. And so I had built these icons called Pictos back in 2008 and 2009. I was, like, slowly building up an icon set, and I decided I'll sell these things to people, but I need a way to sell them. And there was no, like, digital download software. This one called, I think, eJunkie, that worked with PayPal, was out there. But it looked like it was built in the 80s. It was horrid. And so I built this thing called Quixly, and I thought Quixly was going to be my thing, right? I had built a piece of software called FireRift that was, like, downloadable, went nowhere. I spent like 2 years moving to massive debt over it, went nowhere. So I was like, I need to do something. So I built Quixly, which was SaaS. I didn't know it was SaaS, but that's what it was. Software as a service. And I decided I would launch my icon set along with it to kind of show people what you can do with it. And the Quixly software, I mean, it didn't do very good at all. There wasn't zero, but it was not doing very good. Not good enough for me to, like, spend a lot of time on it. But my Pictos icons, like, just took off overnight. Literally an overnight success. And then because it Quixly wasn't that great of a success, though I had, like, tons of ideas and new designs for it and everything, I liked that space. And then Stripe launched in 2009, 2010. And I was a part of their early beta. And I launched a design conference called ValueCon with Stripe, using their beta. And I was like, this thing is so cool. But it's all just an API. There needs to be, like, a human interface. There needs to be, like, UI for this thing. And so I built this thing called Spacebox, which I let my son name. I was like, Daddy's making a new app. He was two years old at the time. I was like, what should I call it? He's like, Spacebox. So I was like, all right, okay. That's what I'll name it. And I ran that for like 2 years, and then decided just to restart, like, start over from scratch, recode it. I'm like, I want like a brandable name that no one is using. So I came up with the name Plasso. It also was an available.com. And then rebuilt it and relaunched it. So that was Spacebox. It was really like an iteration of Quixly to Spacebox to now Plasso. And so in 2014 is when I relaunched it as Plasso. And then I built it for 2 years on my own. And then I raised money for the first time. I had always bootstrapped everything previously. I didn't know any investors, didn't know how to get in touch with them, didn't know anything about raising money. But I was able to put together a small round of like $1.2 million, and then hired some people. And then unfortunately, I made a lot of mistakes on assuming that, you know, if I can get more done, then this thing will take off. And if I can like put fuel on this fire that I have by adding, you know, more features and other people taking over responsibility so I don't have to do everything, then that'll work. Well, that is what you're supposed to do, but you need to have like good product market fit first if you want to survive. And I didn't have that at the time. It was making enough money to pay for me and maybe like one other person. That was it. So unfortunately, it was a slow burn. And I ended up having to let everybody go in like two phases. Let a bunch of people go so that way we could stay alive, kept some people, then had to let those folks go months and months later. So I basically ran out of all the money that I'd raised, which was at, you know, 1.2, and I was back to Plasto just being me. And I remember coming into the office on a Monday morning, and the prior Friday was the last day for the sales guys who were my last employees. And so they had just left, and I come into the office on a Monday morning, and I remember walking through the door being like, all right, this is what you love. It's just back to just you. You got to make it happen. And mind you, in order to make to give this company what I thought was the best chance, just like months prior, I had all at once gone and taken out a bunch of personal loans and credit cards all on the same day so that they wouldn't know about each other. So I had just sunk myself into like 180 grand in debt. So this was like debt that I would never recover from if I didn't make Plasto work. And so was that the Tiger King guy is like, I'll never financially recover from this. Yeah. And so that morning, though, I walk in Monday, turn on my computer. There's an email from GoDaddy saying, hey, we like what you're doing. We'd love to like partner. I'm like, sweet. I'll partner with them. And I can, you know, they can use my shopping cart that I built, et cetera, et cetera. And we get to talking. And it turns out, you know, they're actually hunting for an acquisition. They talked to all the other players in the space and didn't work out with any of them. They didn't like what they had built, but they really liked Plasto. And so I sold the company to them. It was only a little over 3 months of back and forth and diligence, but man, it felt like forever. and so I had nobody on my side to like help me out. I didn't know anybody who'd gone through an acquisition before. So it was like just me figuring it out as I go along, me versus their lawyers. Turns out GoDaddy's super friendly to founders. And so it was a great experience, great deal, you know, coming out of it. And now it powers, you know, their e-commerce today, doing billions of dollars in transactions. So I was there for a little bit, taking what we had built at Plasto and standing it up in GoDaddy.
That's so cool. I remember when I was in your office, I saw the big Plasto sign above your door. It's like a big trophy that you have. It's kind of like a monument of that time. Yeah,
boom, right there.
Yeah.
Yep.
Your office is so interesting. Like when I walked in, seeing all the old Macintoshes and the, you know, basketball cards and the comics, it seems mm-hmm. like we talked about this a little bit. I feel like I'm repeating myself because we talked about all this before. but I remember saying like, it seems like you have a really good work to life balance. Like a lot of people preach that, they talk it, they, you know, have whole like panels about work life balance, but it feels like I get the sense that you sort of live it. Like you hustle, but you also know how to make time for yourself and for your hobbies and for the things that you like to do. Like I remember you talked to me a little bit about how you went on a big RV adventure with your family and just lived on the road for a while. Could you tell me a little bit about that?
Yeah, that was 2015. So I did ValioCon in 2014, and that was the fifth one I had done in a row. And then literally the next week after ValioCon ended in May or June, we left Southern California, and we're going to go live in Washington State for a year. But we only ended up staying there for 6 months. And then we decided to RV the country. Having never even stepped foot in an RV or anything before, or even owned a truck, I bought a giant 42-foot fifth wheel that hooks it in the bed of the truck that I got, which was a F-350 dually 8-foot bed. So this monster. I was as long as a Walmart semi, but just 2 or 3 feet shorter.
Damn, that's a big RV.
Yeah, yeah, it was a big rig.
That's awesome.
Yeah, so we got that. We got rid of everything we had. All of our belongings fit with us in the RV, and then we left, like, you know, photo albums and smaller things in a 8x10 U-Haul storage unit. And that was all that we had. And then we were on the road. We just thought we were just going to, like, go tour around the U.S. We didn't really know what that meant. But we ended up, after seeing so many states, decided to stay in every state. And so we did all the lower 48. We didn't do Alaska or Hawaii, obviously. But we RV'd and stayed in all the lower 48 for a year. And I thought, this is going to be great. I'll have so much time to work, you know, and focus. Yeah, right. Traveling is a full-time job. There's 52 weeks in a year, 42 states. That means like a little over a week per state. And some states like Texas are so huge that you could spend multiple weeks in them. And so that means like every 3 days you have to drive. And it's like all day. So basically I opened my computer like 4 times on the whole trip. And nuked my bank account. I have a habit of nuking my bank account. I did that with every single Plasso, just destroyed my savings. Valiocon. And then the RV trip too. But it was super great. We have so many memories from that trip. I wish our kids were older when we did it. My youngest daughter was 1.
Oh,
so
wow.
She learned to work, walk. Yeah,
cool.
Walk in the RV. Yeah, I have 3 kids and so they were 1, 3, and 5 when we started. But it was great times. I loved seeing the country. And most people I talked to be like, oh, I always hope I wish I could do that one day. Or, you know, maybe one day I'll do that. You know, but I think people should. They should just actually try it out because it's super cool. But yeah, it was a good trip. And I on the work-life balance stuff, I like to think of it more as like a life-life mm-hmm. balance, because most people are spending 8 to 16 hours a day working. And that ends up being most of the hours, your waking hours, right? And so that really is your life. Like it or not, what you're doing at work is your life. And so if you treat it like your life, then I feel like you'll have a better balance, right? Instead of thinking of it as this separate thing, like work I do this, that, and the other, and then life I do this, that, and the other. Like, it should just be your life, and then treat it that way. So I've obviously been super fortunate that I could go on an RV trip. At that point, this is, you know, pre me selling Plasso, and
you're like deep in the weeds.
It's not like I had. Yeah, it's not like I had tons of money to do this. Like, I knew that we were going to do it for a year, so I bought the RV on credit cards. This is the first time I did this hack where I got a bunch of credit cards on the same day so they didn't know about each other. Paid for the entire RV with 6 credit cards, and I asked the RV
That's
sales
awesome.
Guy, I'm like, have you ever seen this? I was like, have you ever seen this before? He's like, I have never seen this. I'm handing him credit card after credit card because, you know, they got certain limits. And the reason I did that is because these cards all had an 18-month no interest window. And so my thought was, we're going to go on this trip for like a year or so, and then I'll sell the RV and I'll pay 0 interest. And that's what happened. So I kind of hacked the system there. Didn't have to pay any interest, which was great. So that's why I did that. But yeah, it's not like I had like some huge amount of wealth or anything. No, we were like struggling financially, but that didn't really matter, right? Because we're having like such a good time seeing the country and, you know, doing this experience that would be very difficult to do later on when you have to negotiate with teenagers. Let's go see the country for a year. Ditch your friends.
Yeah.
So, yeah.
Yeah, when it comes to things like that, you just kind of have to do it, right? Like, I've been studying a lot of philosophy. And by studying, I mean, I've been watching YouTubes, like YouTube videos, like listening to podcasts. That's my version of studying. But yeah. I like Alan Watts, and he's got a saying. It's like, everything in life is play. If you treat everything in your life like play, then it's just your life. Like, you'll work, but treat it like a game. If you're changing diapers, treat it like a game. If you're doing other things, treat it like a game. Keep score. find ways to make it play. And that way everything you do in life is play. It doesn't become work. It's just part of your life. And people who, like, there's another saying, it's like, if you're too afraid to do something, or if you're always staying in the safe zone, you know what's going to happen in your life? Not a whole lot. Like, you got to take risks. You got to go out and do the things that you want to try in your life, because you really only get one shot. And that kind of makes me think of when in my mid to early 20s, I was really into motorcycling. And I read a lot of, like, adventure books, especially in my early, like, early 20s, late teens. I read a lot of Cormac McCarthy books, like All the Pretty Horses, and a lot of Louis L'Amour, and a lot of them deal with, like, young men on adventures and going out into the country and you know, that whole thing. And so for a while I was into motorcycling. I was like, okay, I want to do some motorcycle trips, like not just short trips that, you know, to go to motorcycle shows or whatever. It's like, I want to go to Baja. Like, I want to camp out in Baja and have my own kind of Cormac McCarthy-esque adventure in Mexico. So I had all these, like, ideas in my head of what it was going to be like. I'm like, oh yeah, I'm going to go ride with a bunch of guys and it's going to be really cool. And it's going to be a lot of fun. I'm going to be camping. And, you know, I had all these, like, ideas in my head of what it was going to be like, but none of it was what I pictured. And I learned a lot from that experience. Like, I broke down in the middle of the desert, and luckily I brought my tool bag with me. And the guys I rode with, I didn't really know. I had met them through acquaintances. And as I broke down, one of the guys, I was kind of in the lineup, and I was riding a Harley Sportster that I had, like, ape hangers. It was the whole, like, Easy Rider thing. That's what I wanted. It was the Easy Rider type deal. And my bike immediately breaks down as soon as we're in the Mexicali desert. And one of the guys sees me break down. He looks behind him. He gives me a glance and he keeps going. I'm like, no way. They're just going to keep going. And so I ended up on the side of the road in the desert by myself, trying to figure out how to get my bike working again. And luckily it was something small. It was one of the bolts on my battery loosened up. And so the primary came loose. And so my bike just kind of turned off. So I was able, since I had my tool bag, I was able to, you know, I had extra bolts. I put it on, started right back up again, went going, and I ended up riding about 80 miles solo in the desert until, whoa, I went to the spot where all the rest of the group were all meeting up. And by the time I got there, they had already rested. They had already eaten, gone to the bathroom, and they were ready to go. So I didn't get to really rest. As soon as I went by them, I just flipped them the bird, just kept going. And one of the guys, he came up to me when we went to the campsite, and he's like, oh dude, I'm so sorry. He's like, I guess one of my guys saw you. I didn't see you. And I was like, I was a Boy Scout. I'm fine. I can take care of myself. I brought my stuff. And so that happened. I didn't expect that to happen. I didn't expect how hard it would beat on my body. I didn't expect how hot the desert was actually going to be in Mexico. I had to take off, because I wear pretty much all armor, but I had to take it all off, put it on my pack, and I was just riding in, like, a white t-shirt and my helmet, and because it was so hot. But even though it didn't match my expectations, I kind of live with that memory and live with the lessons learned from that, because I went ahead and went out, tried it, figured out what it was like. So that way I don't, you know, it's kind of cliche, but you got to do things so you don't have regrets. So you can look back and, you know, learn from it, see if you liked it or not, and then just kind of move on with your life. So.
Yeah, dude, that's nuts, getting stuck in the Mexicali desert. At least you were prepared. That's good. I remember once I went to, one of the times I went to Baja in a car, not on a
way better, probably.
Yeah, I was going with some friends, and the one I was following likes to drive fast. And I'm in this, like, you know, foreign country. I've only been there, like, once before. And the line to get into Tijuana back into the US was so long that he's like, actually, let's just go this other way. And he waves me down. I go up to his car, you know, pull up next to his car. I say, let's go to this other, you know, back gate. I know it's like an hour away, but he's like, just follow me. We'll get there. I'm like, okay, fine. So I'm following him, but he's just like ripping and roaring. And he doesn't give a crap. I'm like, oh my gosh, if he makes one more turn, then he's so far ahead and I can't see him. I'm like trying to catch up, but I don't want to get arrested and then, like, you know, never seen from him again or heard from him again. I'm like trying to keep up with him, but, like, don't want to break the law. And I was like, dude, if he goes out of sight, I literally have no idea where I'm at. My cell phone has zero service. This is pre-iPhone. So, like, I have no map. Like, I have no idea, like, what in the world I would do. I would just be hosed. So, because I don't speak the language or read Spanish. So, yeah, it's good that you were prepared. So you
didn't, yeah, and by the time I got to San Felipe, got to the camp out, it was called the El Diablo Run, if you look it up. I forget the group that runs it. But anyway, it's pretty gnarly. As soon as I got to the campsite, I was in a sour mood. I was getting homesick. I ended up just staying one night. It was like supposed to be a weekend thing where you like party with the guys and hang out and have campfires and go swimming in the Gulf of Mexico and stuff. But I was just not in the mood. I was so sour. I spent one night and then I got super homesick, missed my wife. And I was like, I'm just going to head out. And luckily another dude, he was like, hey, are you heading back? And I'm like, yeah, I'm done. He's like, yeah, I'm heading out too. Let's ride together. And I ended up making friends with a guy. And it was just me and him riding through Mexico, getting back to California, going through the border. And we ended up parting ways and we're friends on Instagram. He's still doing the motorcycle thing. I'm kind of taking a break from it. Ever since I moved to Orange County, I picked up surfing and I'm just like, that's my thing now. I've been doing it for 5 years or so. And I go out at least 2 or 3 times a week. So I kind of lost the interest in the motorcycle. And plus being 36 now, dude, my back, I can't take a Sportster anymore. Like I'm glad I did it in my 20s. Cause I couldn't do it now. My back would not be able to take riding a Sportster. So I'm glad I did it overall, but yeah, you kind of have to just make those
shots.
That's
cool, man. Yeah. There's that video series that Ewan McGregor does, Long Way Up, Long Way Around, Long Way Down. That's pretty cool. He goes from LA from the bottom of South America up to LA. It's pretty cool seeing them do that on electric Harleys.
Yeah, and probably have better suspension too. Cause I wouldn't call my bike a piece of crap because it got me home, but like I was really very much into tinkering with it and, you know, making modifications and stuff. And it's kind of older. So, it was fun, but yeah, you kind of just have to make those risks and, you know, you really need, when you have the opportunity, you have to take it and you have to plan for it and you have to do it because life, it just moves so fast.
Yeah, man, I would say like, yeah, I got such sage advice when I first went to GoDaddy from a buddy of mine who was there, who's probably 15, 17 years my senior. And I met him because he had just sold his company to GoDaddy the year prior to mine, a much larger deal than mine was. But he at the time was, I believe, in his late 50s, cresting on early 60s, I believe. And he was like, oh, are you going to take a vacation? You know, this unlimited vacation policy. I'm like, I don't know. And he's like, you got to. I'm like, yeah. I'm like, maybe later. He's like, no, you can't say that. He's like, because suddenly you'll wake up and you'll be my age and you'll wish you would have done all this stuff. And I'm like, gosh, dang it. He's right. And so, yeah, I started, you have to make a conscious effort. You can't just like, oh, one day I'll get around to it. You have to like literally be like, well, I just have to do it. Like, I just have to like figure out a time, figure out where I'm going, plan it and do it. Otherwise, no one's going to do it for you. And so I started consciously trying to actually take vacations because I've traditionally been super horrible about ever doing that. And trying to do actual vacations because, you know, when you got a family and everything, the vacation you do is always like, oh, you go back and see family. That's not a vacation. I mean, it's great to see family, but there's no relaxing involved. You're driving here, driving there, driving. It's not a vacation. So like actual vacations, is something that, you know, I was horrible at doing before because I always felt like I don't want to spend that money on myself. You know, I'd rather like, if I'm going to spend money on myself, I'd rather it to be like a newer computer if I need one or like some setup for my house or, you know, something like that. So, one of the things I started doing was one of my good buddies who I, met when I moved down to SoCal, actually he moved down with me. It was supposed to be my good friend and then this other guy, and my good friend chickened out. And so this other guy and I moved down and I didn't really know him, but he ended up becoming my best friend. And so I told him, I was like, dude, we're getting older and we're never going to see each other because you now live in Ohio and I live in SoCal still. So we just got to like make time. And so since 2019. We skipped 2020 because of COVID, but every year we take a week and we just like do something. It's actually like 5 days, but we do something. So yeah. And so it's something I look forward to, like planning, because we like, it's not always the same. Like one of the times we rented an RV in Salt Lake, because that's the closest place to Yosemite. You can rent an RV, and we just RV'd up to Yosemite and hung out there RVing around. And then this year, we're going to do a backpacking trip and camp in the Appalachia, and try to avoid being eaten by bears, because we picked the springtime. And so we'll see how it goes. But later next month, I'm going to go do that, which is going to be super fun.
It's funny, when I moved back to Orange County, I just so happened to run into my old high school buddy, and he's like, I call him my neighbor. I mean, he's a couple exits down, but I mean, he's close enough that I call him my neighbor now. But I hadn't seen the guy since before we graduated. And I moved back to Orange County around 2018, 2019, for a job that, I mean, I'm obviously no longer working at. But I ran into him and I was like, oh, you're living in Orange County? He's like, yeah, man, I'm in Orange County. I was like, holy shit. And so I was like, we should jam, because back in high school, we would jam together. We would play guitars, and we had a really, really terrible sounding band. And I say band in a loose term. We're just dudes hanging out at a buddy's house with a really bad drum set, you know, two electric guitars, and playing Scorpion songs, basically, because we love that type of like glam metal or whatever. And so we're like, dude, we should start a bar band in Orange County. He's like, hell yeah, let's do it. And he's like, I got a buddy I can hit up and let's jam some songs. And so every week we hang out, jam together. If we don't feel like jamming, we'll play darts or something at a bar and do like karaoke or something. But it's just wild how like I hadn't seen the guy in forever, and now once a week I have a dude night where we're either jamming or playing darts, and now we're going to be doing a bar band sort of situation. We got 4 or 5 songs pretty much in the bag, but we want to get like a good lineup and just be a local bar band in Orange County, which is so funny.
That's awesome, dude. That is awesome. Yeah, it sucks that you know, life is as short as it is, because there's so many things that I want to do and go deep on, and I know that I just will never be able to. It's so horrible.
Tell me about when we last talked. You said that you had a movie in mind. Like you said, if you had more time, you have this movie that you want to make. Tell me about your movie.
Yeah, there's a few of them. So I've written like outlines and started a script on some of them, but it's hard to like commit the time. There was actually, when I was on my RV trip, I was seriously, not like just tossing around in my mind, I was seriously considering and planning, making plans to get out of tech and just learn to become an actor and make movies that way. But what I realized is like, I have zero desire to be one of the bajillion trying to get it rolled just to say the word, look out, you know, in some movie. What I want to do is make movies. That's what I want to do. And so the better way to go about it would not be leave tech, because I have super deep experience and connections there. But it would be to make enough money so that way I can make movies. And so, yeah, that's my focus. That's like what I really, really want to do. I've always wanted to make movies since I was a kid. And so there's other things that I want to do almost just as bad, but since this one is the one I want to do the most, it'll be the thing that I'm going to do. So yeah, want to make movies, starting with like some sci-fi films that I've got. Gosh, it's just, yeah, it would be so much fun to actually do this stuff and produce this stuff. But, you know, it's very difficult for an outsider just to go make a movie, because it's all like connections. Mm-hmm. And now it's becoming like so much easier, where you could just like make a movie on YouTube and make it be a YouTube video. That's like not what I want. I don't want to like have the animation and the pixels and the audio in a video form. That's not what I want. I want to make a movie that has a theatrical release and a poster and people talk about it. That's what I want. So it's not about how hard or easy is it to make a movie these days, you know, especially with like AI and everything, it's that Hollywood movie making process that I want to be involved in and a part of. So it's more than just the actual, I guess, filming of it, you know. It's that whole other bit that I've always been attracted to and love. Like I with the money that I made, with some of the money that I made selling plasma, I built myself a movie theater. And not like a small one, like a pretty big one.
It's in your office, right?
18 seater.
That's sick. I saw that at a glance and I was like, should I bring that up? I'm like, I don't want to be weird. I was like, but that is awesome. So I didn't bring it up.
Yeah. Like a big one. And I'm in there like not every single night, but literally like at minimum three nights, sometimes four nights a week watching movies. And my family and I have always done family movie nights since our kids were like infants. Every Friday night we do family and we make pizza, family movie night, pizza night. And so for me, it's like a big deal. It's like a big part of me. I would love to, you know, move from like being a viewer to a maker in that space.
You know, what's funny, you and I are way more alike than I had initially thought, because there was a stint where I spent way too much money. I was like, I'm going to give being a storyboard artist a shot. So I went to the Concept Art Academy in Pasadena. I did a couple of workshops. I met this artist, John Watkiss, and I wouldn't say he became my mentor. He barely knew me, but he was such an influence to me that it got me like hooked on storyboard drafting. And so I spent a ton of money, way too much money, learning how to draw storyboards with charcoal and Sharpie the John Watkiss way. And John Watkiss was a Disney storyboard artist from the mid 90s to the early 2000s. He did some storyboards for like The Walking Dead in their first couple seasons. And if you look him up, his art is so good. It's so phenomenal. He's got this John Singer Sargent way of taking shapes and just making something that just looks so detailed. But if you really look at it, it's all shapes and geometry. But the way that he drafts it together just blows your mind. So I spent a couple years. I did some classes at Noman Art Studio in L.A. This is like 2016. I did the Pasadena thing. I did like scenery painting on location with a guy who worked on Mulan. And the rest of the class, they were all like working in the industry. Like some people were working at Blizzard, some people were working at the WB. Like, hey, what are you doing? I'm like, I'm a web designer, asshole. I'm just here to like learn how to paint. I'm not in the industry. And so I was I really gave it a shot. And I was like, let me see if I can actually do this. And I got one storyboard gig from a director buddy of mine, Titus Richard. He was doing a movie. And he asked me to draw some storyboards for him. And I did a pretty good job, but I realized how difficult it is to actually do quality storyboards, like to make a lot of them and to set a scene, to do the perspective, to do the focal point, to establish the characters and all do it in a really quick way and deliver it. I was like, man, this is hard. And I'm like, I could either do this or I can make a five-pager website and make twice as much money. And so I was like, at the end of the day, I was like, I know I've been doing web design my entire adult life, like my entire adult life, starting from helping my buddies make their MySpace pages with CSS up to now where I'm running my own small company and I have a couple clients and I'm doing that deal. And I'm like, I can do this as a hobby. I don't see myself going full-fledged storyboard artist. And then I just kind of, I wouldn't say that I dropped it. I still do art here and there and little bits of digital art. And I did like a story. I did a book cover for a buddy of mine, in Photoshop and digital painting, but no, I was like, I am a web designer. This is the best I'm going to be at this particular field. I should just keep doing this. But it's just so funny how you're kind of like the same way that you're kind of exploring your side quests, so to speak.
Yeah. 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 Hopefully it becomes my main quest. that's the goal. Yeah. We'll see though. I don't know. I'm just one of those people that always has ideas. And the hard part is like picking one to focus on. And after I sold Plasso, I was like, I'm done with this maker business. Like, I don't want to be making tons of bajillions of little tiny apps. Like, it's fun and I will always enjoy it, but I don't want to do it anymore. I want to like focus on one thing and go as big as I possibly can. And that's what Letter That Bank I started was. But it didn't work out. You know, most startups don't work out. And most things I've done don't work out. Only a few of them have. And so then, you know, having built and sold a company and then, you know, went through the process of raising way more money than I had the last time. With Letter, I raised way more than I did with Plasso, and went through YC and did the whole Silicon Valley approach. It's difficult now. You know, it's always better when you're naive and you don't really know what you're getting into. Once you have a good amount of experience, it's like, it's difficult. For me, it's not difficult to launch something new. I mean, I just launched like two new products in the last month. But what's difficult is like, you know how the game works. And you know how hard it is to have something take off. And because of that, it's like so much more, it's so much more discouraging. Because you've already, like for me, I've already had like a good success. I've already had tons of products fail. I've already done the Maker thing. I've done the Silicon Valley thing. And so I've never had like a unicorn, right? And that's what I was trying to do with Letter. And I would still like to do that. I want to build a big business. But you know, it's so incredibly hard, and it's mostly due, you know, once you're at the level where you can convince like investors to give you money and you're good at what you do, your designs look good, your product strategy is great, like you have just as good a shot as anybody else. And it's all about market timing and the thing you chose to work mm-hmm. on, right? And it's less about you as a leader. That's why when you look at every one of the bajillion of business books and leadership books that are out there, they all have their own style, because what they did, like, you know, Reed Hastings and Netflix, No Rules Rules, what he did worked for him at that time. And he can write a book about it because he built Netflix, and Netflix is enormous. Well, Netflix is enormous because of the timing. And you know, they were early, and he will admit, and he does in his book, that he's not, you know, the best at running companies. You try to get him to do that again, usually doesn't work. Look at most CEOs who go out after something, doing something big, and they try to do their second and it doesn't work out. It has almost nothing to do with their management style, leadership style. At some point, all those people are just good leaders, right? And you look at the variance in ways that they approach leadership and building businesses, it's so varied. And what that means is that is not the ticket. That is their leadership style, or whatever they did and how they built the company, is not what made it successful. What made it successful was the demand of the market. And you have to put yourself out there. You have to make something in order to be successful, right? You have to like force luck to fall on yourself by actually doing something and being good. But there is a threshold that a lot of people are at. So many middle managers at larger companies who tried and failed, they're just as good as the CEO at their company. But you know, it didn't work out for them. And that's like the really discouraging part, is to know that, like, especially someone who's very ambitious and who loves the idea of, if I practice, I can get better over time, that it doesn't matter how good you get. That does not guarantee the outcome that you're looking for, you're hoping for, the success, this ultimate freedom that you want, like, does not come to those who are the best necessarily. Sometimes not, right? That's why there's fools running large companies.
Yeah, you just have to like go for it, right? Like, I mean, you've been overly gracious with your time. I want to be respectful of your time. Since this is our second, recording, you let me into your office. You let me lurk around. You're very kind. But I have one last question for you. ValueCon. That's one of the regrets I have in my life. If we're going to talk regrets, I had the chance to go to ValueCon. I did not. I don't remember what got in the way. So, ValueCon 2024, 2025. maybe, possibly.
Well, definitely not 2024, but but I actually am talking with somebody about bringing it back, another conference organizer. And so we'll see. Could be cool. I would love to do it just because it's fun. They never like make any money. And as a matter of fact, like I said before, I lost all my savings every time I did it, except the last two times I made like, you know, basically the equivalent of a valet's tip. But yes, I would love to do it. I feel like there's been a long pause on non-corporate industry events, right? So like there's the Stripe sessions, the Figma configs, those all exist still and people hang out there. But there's not, those independent conferences kind of went away and ValueCon was one of those. So yes, it would be great to bring it back. So
nice,
we'll see.
Nice.
Hopefully next
year. Well, I'm going to thank you once again for being on the podcast. Thanks for hanging out with me. Thanks for sharing your stories. Yeah, man, I would love to see your office again or would hang out or check out Oceanside or whatever, man. So once again, thank you for being on Talk Product and thank you for recording with me today.
Yeah, man. Thanks for having me.
No problem.
My pleasure.
See you, Drew.